Punycode helper, :, email to UTF-8, right? So it's like explicitly doing Punycode
right.
De-encoding, I guess.
Right.
Decoding. De-encoding, I just said.
Decoding.
I promise English is my first language, guys.
Unde-encoding.
Oh my God, please stop, Joel. No. Alrighty, y'all, hold up for just a sec, because we've all heard of living off the land as a red teamer technique, right? Well, unfortunately, I just got off a call with the Threat Locker team, and they said that isn't going to fly anymore thanks to the ring fencing feature. Let me double click on that for you, okay? Think of ring fencing as like an invisible fence around your applications. As soon as an application interacts with some app or system resource that it normally doesn't, bam, it gets blocked. Even if that thing is native to the OS, like PowerShell.exe or CertUtil.exe. So yeah, rip living off the land. Back to the drawing board for the red team, I guess. Anyway, if you want to see this in action, head over to threatlocker.com for a demo. And when you do, ask for my guy, Andrew. His demo was very to the point and he had great answers to all my technical questions. Check it out, y'all. Seriously, don't sleep on Threat Locker, especially not in this recent landscape of EDR uncertainty. Am I right? Yeah, I'm right. Okay, y'all know. All right, let's get back to the show. Yo, dude. All right, check this out. Check this out. I got a good way to start this episode.
Okay.
Boom.
Space raccoon pillow.
You see this boy, dude, right here? This, dude, is a that, space raccoon
pillow. Is
that pillow.
Wedding swag?
This is wedding swag.
That's crazy.
There was a competition. Shout out to my boy Thilo who gave this to me. There's a competition at Space Raccoon's wedding. For those of you that are listening to a podcast in audio, like a total psychopath, I am holding up a pillow of Space Raccoon, one of my favorite hackers out there. And at his wedding, there was a competition of like, you know, how well do you know Space Raccoon or whatever? Not Space Raccoon, you know, his name's Eugene, right? But I always call him Space Raccoon. And there's like this whole thing. And unfortunately, like our team didn't win it perfectly because of like, they also showed like vacations that they'd been on and been like, what city is this? I'm like, I don't know. Like,
dude, we were like GeoGuessr.
I know,
like,
dude.
Pros for and like 2 weeks.
I gotta give a shout out to, one of the people on my team, because she's like, that is the mountains in Italy, and I'm like, that is not the mountains in Italy, like we're going Switzerland, we're going France,
dude,
and we did,
okay,
and she was
I
right
cannot
Italy,
make
so
this
my
up
bad.
I cannot make this up, like literally I cannot make this up. Okay, I use a Chrome extension.
Uh-huh.
It's called what is it called, Moment or something?
Dude, you can't
Momentum.
Tell people what Chrome extensions you use, man.
I use a Chrome extension.
Be in your browser.
It's called Momentum. Okay. It's like when you open a new tab, it like shows you the time and stuff. The background picture is a lovely mountain range. And at the bottom, it tells me where it's located.
Where is it?
Which is in Italy.
Oh my gosh, dude. Given that up. Dude, what was the name of that range? I want to say... No, it's not the Calanx, that's France. What is the mountain range in Italy that you're seeing? Maybe it's the same one.
Let's see. It's in Gieler. Wow, I do not.
Yes,
know how to
dude.
Pronounce this.
Yeah, exactly.
The Gieler Peaks.
Dude, okay, what the heck? That might have been it. That's crazy. It was definitely something that started with a G. I can't remember it right now, but that's coincidental. Anyway, I just had to flex this swag on the people because there are very few people in the world that have a space raccoon pillow. And I literally went up to Thilo and the guys in the team that won this afterwards. I was like, listen, guys, I need that. You'll understand. Like, I really need that. Like, this is serious bragging rights for me in the security world. And they're like, all right, sure, Justin, whatever, take it. You know, like,
all right, you need to put a shelf on your back wall.
Dude, I'm gonna find somewhere to put it. I kind of want to like put it right by this monitor here or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, shout out to my boy Thilo. I tried to bribe him with like $100. I was like, man, I'll give you $100 USD, and he's like, dude, just take it. Like, and I'm like, really? Like, so.
Dang.
All right.
That's
so
awesome.
What are we doing today? We are discussing DEF CON research.
DEF CON. Not Black Hat.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah. I mean, there is some Black Hat. Well,
okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Security summer camp research episode. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, and there was a lot, dude.
there was a ton. I mean, at this point, it's impossible to like keep up. I feel like.
Yeah. But we're going to do our best to help you guys.
Yeah. Like maybe like 5-10 years ago, you go to DEF CON, you could probably see like a lot of the talks. Mm-hmm. Now it's so difficult to see like. I mean, there's like 3-4 tracks, right? Plus the village tracks, plus...
The villages were fire this year, man.
Yeah. Yeah, the Bug Bounty Village was awesome. There was like a lot of really good stuff going on. So we met a bunch of people at the Bug Bounty Village, which was really cool.
Shout out to the squad we met over there. That was great. Dude, this is my first time, you know, in Vegas as a content creator. And it rocks, man. People are always like constantly coming up to you, be like, hey, it's you. And I'm like... Yeah, who are you? You know, like, and they're like,
I think I had a dream about that last night where somebody was like, yo, Techno Geek, I listen to the pod. And I was like, hello.
Dude, we need to refine our skills on that a little bit. Like, I feel like I was not prepared going into Vegas for that. And I need to like learn how to like carry the conversation and like, you know, have that interaction. I think it went fine in general. Yeah. But, you know, if I had a weird interaction with you guys, sorry about that, like I wasn't really expecting all that, so
get to watch a edited version of 1 hour of us being probably as normal as possible.
Dude, I don't know, man. We've been goofy as heck the past couple weeks, so shout out to all y'all that made us feel very special and loved at DEF CON. Really appreciate that. Cool. That was great,
very
guys.
Cool meeting everybody. We gave out a bunch of stickers. I think we need to print like 5 times as many next time.
We ordered like what, 150, 300 stickers or something like that. I mean, I think two batches of 150.
Yeah. We were like, oh, this is going to be plenty. Tons. Mm-mm. And in like 5 minutes, I had like 10 left. I
was like, oh, God. They were gone fast. And we had to start rationing them. We're like, all right, we're going to take one pack per day, per person. You know,
I had to take some for myself because I was like, I'm going to run out of these before.
That's funny. Yeah, we get to the end and we're like, ah, my laptop doesn't have a CTBB sticker on it. Like, that's funny, dude. We also gave out a bunch of swag. We do have the swag store live, which is great. So we've got that over at ctbb.show/swag. So check that out if you guys want, if you didn't get one at Vegas. And the Critical Thinkers, of course, get a very steep discount on the swag. So if you're a Critical Thinker in the Discord, then check out that discount code that's in the exclusive content channel. And with that, Joel, I think we move into the content. I have selected four write-ups that is pretty much going to be all we have time for today. And we actually may need to come back and do like another episode after all the videos air and stuff like that, because the ones that we chose for this episode, essentially all the Portswigger team, and then Orange, who we can't ignore.
Portswigger team and Orange, yeah.
You know, they did really nice like text write-ups as well of their research, which I really appreciated. But I'm sure there's a lot of people that just did videos and or just did the presentation and didn't like do a text version as well. So I definitely am looking forward to when everything comes out where we can go and watch back some of the other research.
Yeah, absolutely. I know a lot of stuff was live streamed, so certain things might already be live. I haven't checked to see.
Oh yeah, that's true. They did live stream this year.
Yeah, I haven't checked to see how many talks are like split into their own videos and stuff online yet, or how they're gonna do all that. But I think they're usually pretty quick with it. So I would imagine. What was that reaction?
I opened up the DEF CON like YouTube channel and it goes like super loud, like extremely loud. I think maybe your mic is down low, so I've got you turned up. And then I went to this page and it was like super loud.
Oh man, I'll turn myself up a little bit right now. Sorry to our audio editor.
Yeah, sorry Richard. Okay, gotcha. Yeah, I mean, it seems like there are some videos up here, so that's interesting. We'll have to go back and try to view some of those in prep for next week. But it is heavy, man. The prep is heavy for these DEF CON episodes.
It's like a full-time job, right? Like, I think in order to educate people on a topic like this, like, you know, either you or them has to read through the entire thing, learn it, understand it, and then be able to explain it. So it's definitely, it's a lot of, like, content consumption to be able to, like, understand the research.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Okay, I'll start us off with this first one. Of course, we're going to start off with the man, the myth, the legend, James Kettle, in his research this year. This is entitled Listen to the Whispers web time. Okay, well, also, hold on. Let me just go back for a sec. I promise you we will get to the research, but the idea behind this episode is for us to go through this research and take the pieces out that you need to know about and you can practically integrate into your hacking methodology and then talk about those. So, I would also recommend that you go and read all these research pieces, papers and stuff. But if you're just listening to the podcast, the hope is that your hacker brain should be primed so that when you see something that relates to this, you might think, okay, maybe I need to go back and reread that research or something like that. Or maybe you get some nice takeaways that you can just integrate into your methodology as a freebie rather than having to go and read all this research. So that's the thought for this. And with that, Listen to the Whispers, Web Timing Attacks by James Kettle. This research, I think, was really interesting. I think my take on this is that it's not normal James quality, in my opinion. Like, I think James normally has some stuff that is extremely, like, internet breaking and massive, right? And I think this is very useful. I think this is a useful tool. And he even says this throughout the write-up. He says, if you ignore timing, you're going to miss out. But if you focus too much on it, then you also miss out. So yeah. I think this is less of a internet breaking technique like we've seen in past years, and more of you just got to kind of know how to utilize these timing attacks in the way that he describes here so that you can exploit some really fringe situations in black box scenarios.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one really interesting thing about this isn't exclusive to James's research, yeah, but a lot of this sort of very specific, specifically scoped research, like these timing mm-hmm. attack stuff that he's been working on for the last however many years, mm-hmm. What you'll find is that the large organizations who end up being, at a certain point super secure, that's probably where this is going to start to come into play. And the ones who have secured almost every attack vector except for these super weird, like niche, mm-hmm. like architecture specific, stuff, yeah. That's where, and it's going to be super critical, right? Mm-hmm. But it's that sort of research, like, has to be like very targeted and fine point mm-hmm. for it to come out. And I think especially, with the previous research that he's done, that's helped to secure so many other, the attack vectors and so much of the stack as a whole that, just naturally, this is going to start to be like more specific and more like harder to exploit and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And I think he says in the write-up as well, these things are everywhere, these timing attacks. But I think you're right in that the only places where they really need to be exploited are in these really, really like super fringe scenarios. And that being said, there is some really cool techniques that we'll talk about from this that I definitely think you should know about that are really amazing and applicable in a lot of ways. But the actual exploitation of this at large, I think, already requires there to be some sort of sketchy functionality. And then you are taking that and building upon it and using timing attacks to like gain more information about what's going on and that sort of thing. So I think that's really cool. I just want to clarify something I said. Like, this is 100% James quality research. Like the research is very thoroughly done, very well documented, very thorough technique. Like, clearly this guy is a master researcher, right? I just the stuff that I'm used to seeing from him is like, oh shit, if I do not implement this right now, then I'm going to be missing out big time, right? And I think this is, like we said, more of an exploitation technique. So with that, let me kind of go into some of the stuff that he did here that was pretty cool. One of the things that came out of this was dual packet sync as a methodology to sort of be close to that single packet attack that and improve upon the single packet attack that he had been using before. And essentially what this new technique ensures is that the HTTP server doesn't start processing the HTTP headers before it gets the body. Because how single packet attack normally works is you would just sync the last piece of it and in one packet, and that would cause everything to get processed at once. But what he figured out was that some servers were actually starting to process the HTTP headers before they got the rest of the last mm-hmm. little data frame from the body. And using this technique, he was able to make it all sync together so that everything, including the headers, get processed at the exact same time, which is pivotal for this sort of very, very granular type of timing attack that he talks about in this paper. Because it's like, I mean, in one of the scenarios, he was exploiting like a 0.2...
Okay, like let me microseconds think. Or
a point
right?
two, yeah, you could call it nanoseconds, but I'm gonna say like 0.2 millisecond difference in some of the stuff. Like he was just very consistently seeing that this one takes just tiny bit longer, which is just super badass. Like, and I totally agree that like I thought this level of timing attack was not possible, but after seeing the way that he implements it in here with you know getting the server to process it exactly at the right time, I think it's pretty well solved. I think he's made timing attacks practical with these tools.
Yeah, I mean, it's really cool. I think this has made me think a bit about like the efficiency aspects that go into a lot of software, especially for like large organizations. When you think about like, you know, Google, for example, like think about how many requests per second Google has to process. And not only that, not just process, but they have to be able to like run it through other software stack and like have middleware and routing and all this kind of stuff. And they need that to happen in like 2 milliseconds, right? And so there are certain engineering decisions that have to be made in order to make a piece of software that can operate at that speed. And doing stuff like parsing the headers, like as the packets are coming in, are like the decisions that lead to these kinds of vulnerabilities, right? So I think that could probably be a really interesting research point if somebody wants to like go deep dive. Something like Envoy, for example, it's like a large scale like edge routing software that's used by a lot of organizations. I wouldn't be surprised if there is something similar there, because efficiency like is key when it comes to processing requests like this.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, at scale, if you can cut off just a little bit of time, you know, in server load, it has a massive impact.
Yeah.
And some of those things will cause vulnerabilities inevitably. So so two more points here that I wanted to hit before we talk about some of the other like more practical vulnerability stuff that he sort of coined new terms for. One, he used a really cool technique in here that I think is a little bit odd because of the way that it is, but I think is a cool thing to know about nonetheless, which is he was trying to detect reverse proxies using these timing attacks. And he was able to detect whether DNS resolution, like blocking DNS resolution, was occurring by using a DNS record that has an overlong domain segment. What is the actual technical term? I didn't write it down. But essentially, you know, domain label, I believe.
Oh.
So like one of the segments of the domain, right? If you make that, I want to say 65, maybe it's 60, yeah, greater than 64. So if you make it 65 characters, then it won't even attempt resolution. It'll say, hey, that's not a valid domain. Like, I'm not going to touch that, right? So if you send one that has like 63 or 64, and then you see a certain response time and you see one that says 65, and then it's a shorter response time, then you can say with pretty good certainty that that domain or that DNS resolution is not occurring, and or that is occurring and that isn't occurring afterwards, right? So you can tell that differential and then use that to determine whether you're dealing with something that's actually resolving that host and might be a reverse proxy or is not resolving it.
It's such cool research because it's like invisible fingerprinting where it's just like, you know, it's like the next level of error message, like Googling error messages. You know, it's like, oh, this responded in 60 milliseconds. It's Apache. Like,
yeah, dude, it is really crazy. You know, and I also, he uses a really awesome technique as well. And I think this kind of goes into how versatile you should really be as a hacker and how various areas of expertise can apply to hacking in a really good way. He uses some statistical analysis on all of these to make sure that he removes any sort of confounding variables that might be occurring with like spikes in server load and that sort of thing by just using the lower quartile of response times. And he found that that gives him the best picture. And that's not like some crazy statistical technique, right? Like, oh, I'm like charting it and then doing this and standard deviation or whatever. But it is like a pretty useful piece. And I think having that in my brain, in knowing like, okay, well, if I want to, you know, reduce volatility in these timing attacks, I should use the bottom quartile of responses, because anything longer than that, something else is happening clearly in the server, right? Because that bottom quartile is going to represent the fastest that it's being processed. And so, yeah, just kind of having that in my head and knowing that, I think is one of those great little like, boop, takeaways from the paper of like, okay, if I am doing timing attacks, that's how I should approach it.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a weird thing when you think about just that, like, almost like seemingly randomly, right? Some requests will just like go slower or not work because
server load or whatever, right?
Server load, like something else is going on. Like, it's just like, it's very, you know, we like to think that computers are super, super consistent. But no, they definitely aren't, because there's like so many other external factors that can affect stuff, which makes this even just a little bit more impressive again, because like the precision that was being done down to like the nanosecond on some of these attacks is just like crazy, crazy.
It really is. It really is. Okay. So the other thing that he had here was he coined a new term, which is called scoped SSRF, okay? And so this is a new variant of SSRF, sort of. And this occurs essentially when you are only allowed to perform an SSRF to hosts that are in a certain subdomain. So let's say, you know, I'm attacking Google, I can only hit, you know, whatever.google.com, right? Okay. And he coined this term in the, on the section of the paper where he was talking about how to discover these sort of reverse proxies, right? Which is very similar to the research he did many, many years ago on host header stuff and finding crazy, crazy hosts that you can access via host headers. And he differentiated it, a reverse proxy, from vhost scanning, which is vhost is just when other hosts are using that same server. And he differentiated and said, you know, this is sort of a different scenario with reverse proxies, because you've actually got a server that is a reverse proxy that is reaching out to a different server on the internal network based off of the host header that you're providing. And one of the cool techniques that he did over this whole piece of research was essentially building out a good way to identify these reverse proxies pretty consistently. And that is the architectural decision that they're making, using that sort of DNS trick and some other timing stuff to identify these reverse proxies in the organization, and then hitting those reverse proxies a little bit harder with like vhost scanning, or not really vhost scanning, but like host header scanning, right? To see if you can pivot into different parts of the network. And I thought that was a really elegant solution. And I think that's something that I could easily see like AssetNode or like some of those people that are doing very wide scanning and really wanting good understanding of network topology of their targets, implementing that in like a microservice or whatever, and just saying, okay, well, XYZ organization has three reverse proxies. They're here, here, and here, because now we've got a more actionable way of actually testing this. So that was a big one. I think that was a big one, a big takeaway from the research, and absolutely very cool.
Yeah, super cool. I didn't see whether or not he called it out, but I am really curious like what the root cause of that, as like the scoped SSRF stuff, is in terms of like, because I know it mentions just sort of like misconfiguration of reverse proxy, but you know, from like an AppSec side, it's always nice to know like what can you actually fix, like how
Joel's,
do you fix
Joel's brain is spinning like do I have a reverse proxy anyway? So essentially what it is when the reverse proxy is configured to hit any like star.whatever.com, right? And then it's you know, you can pivot into the internal network and abuse that firewall or that DMZ position, right? You know, where that reverse proxy is on the internet and in the internal network and sort of allows for internal pivoting. And then he does that, right, of course, via that timing attack plus that DNS resolution piece of like, okay, if I see a very significant statistical difference between the response of a 64 character domain label and a 65, then it's a very good chance that there is some DNS resolution happening that is taking, you know, 100 milliseconds or whatever. And that's why we're seeing that difference.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I mean, it's really crazy. I mean, and again, it's just like, oh, it took 60 milliseconds. It's Apache. Like, it's like, it's such like a, it's like a, this invisible like fingerprinting where like, what's wrong with it? Like, nothing's wrong with it. This is how it behaves, right?
Yeah. And he says that throughout the paper. He's like, yeah, there's not really like a bunch of great defenses for this, you know, because it's just how stuff works, you know?
Start adding random response delays to sleep, every single
sleep like three.
It's like the anti-efficiency, like, just like, okay, now we're gonna add random amounts of delay so they can't fingerprint what our, systems are.
So bad, dude. But those are the worst kind of things, right? Like, if there's literally no fix to this, like, what are you gonna do, you know? So, okay, last little piece. I was talking with Franz, and actually I think probably this episode will air before the one that we recorded with Franz. So you guys will hear more about this, I think, next week. If the ordering goes right, we'll see. Depends on how long we run today. but Franz was recently talking about JSON injection with me. And I thought that was really interesting because I don't really hear a lot about JSON injection. And then James also mentioned JSON injection in this research. And it just starts getting you thinking, right? Like, two of the most respected hackers that I know of, right, are both talking about this at the same time, and it's not something that I hear about a lot. That's probably something that should trigger some thoughts, right? So I don't really know what that looks like yet. Franz seemed to insist in that episode that there are scenarios where people are essentially building JSON blobs with string concat, and you're able to actually add other attributes and stuff like that into that JSON blob. I have not seen that very often, but he insists that it's around. And then James is also mentioning something like this in his research. So I just wanted to put that out there for the people, you know, the curious critical thinking listeners out there that will also poke and think and, you know, start identifying patterns in their targets because, two big names are really interested in that right now. So.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And just like, I'll say like injection in general, I feel is making a comeback. You know, people used to think of it as like SQL injection, but it's basically, it's the same thing. It's just in all the other technologies, right? So, okay, you're building a JSON object. Yep, JSON object injection, right? You're concatenating a string. You can escape that property with like an ending quote and then start to add new properties in. GraphQL injection, like, again, like, building queries with string concatenation, like string concatenation and just inserting strings without sanitizing them or without having like a proper flow, right? Like, the traditional solution for SQL injection is prepared statements, which like pre-calculates a path. So you have to figure out like what is the prepared statement for JSON, right? Like, you build the object and then you specifically like go attribute by attribute or something, right? Like, you know, there are secured ways to do it, but I think in a lot of places, people have gotten lax because there's not a traditional security risk associated with it. And people go, I mean, what's wrong with concatenating a string in a JSON object? Like, what's going to happen? Well, you know, maybe you're able to pass that into a function that then interprets those as parameters. And, you know, you're able to override parameters or add additional options that weren't,
Published. Talking too much about Franz's research for next episode, like, that's exactly what he was talking about, like being able to inject in these sort of trusted JSON blobs and then be able to overwrite specific pieces, specific attributes because of like deduplication of attributes and that sort of thing. Very interesting stuff. Very interesting stuff.
Yeah, very cool.
I'll definitely be paying more attention to scenarios where I think that could be occurring. And we'll see where that goes over the next couple of years. All right. That's all I had for James's research. You have anything else on that?
I don't think so. I mean, hopefully we did it justice. I mean, it's definitely worth giving it a read. So if you're unsure about anything that we said or wanted some more clarification, go check out the article on the Portsberger research page.
Yeah, absolutely. I know James listens. So James, I'm sorry if I messed something up, man. Like, forgive me, but master of security research. But I think it was good. All right, where do you want to go next? Because we're pretty much hitting the... Let me just pause and also say, like, the Portswigger team crushed it this year with research.
Yeah.
And really, like, we're going to spend pretty much this whole time talking... I should probably title this episode, like, Portswigger research, you know, brain dump or something like that, because, like, it's pretty much all Portswigger research, and then we're going to talk a little bit about Orange at the end.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how many talks they submitted, but I know they had at least these three that got accepted. So
very impressive.
I mean, it just goes to show that there's a lot of really awesome research going on over at Portswigger, right?
Yeah. Where do you want to go next? You want to do the gotta cash them all, or do you want to do the splitting the email atom?
Let's do the splitting the email. That one's really cool.
All right, cool. You want to take that one or should I?
Well, let's take it together. So, this research was from Gareth Hayes, who we talked about, inventor of Hackverter, inventor of
Shazzer,
which I think just released. You can now use your friends' browsers to like fuzz your JavaScript payloads or something.
Pretty awesome.
I don't know.
It's pretty cool. So
he tweeted something out about that. But yeah. Basically, this research all centers around the email format RFC, which is what RFC 2822, I think, is what it says. So basically, it just talks about, like, you know, RFCs are really interesting, and I think probably at least once a year there's some sort of talk at either DEF CON or Black Hat about an RFC that is not being interpreted correctly, or is being interpreted too correctly, or maybe it was written in a way such that there are pitfalls that nobody really thinks about. And so I think email address parsing is definitely probably one of the bigger ones, right? I mean, this has been talked about for a while. I think I want to say Zshana was the one who really made that popular initially, of putting XSS payloads in email.
I saw him talk about it, but for me, the first interaction with this was Inti's research on it back in the day, and then you know, with Ticket Trick and a bunch of other stuff like that, and then I know Rojan also took it for a little while and did some stuff with it. So there's been a lot of people that have poked at this email RFC, and Gareth comes in and like blows our minds with more of that. So something says that there's probably more to be discovered in the email research realm.
Yeah. I mean, if nothing else, this I know that he had to update this article actually afterwards, and he was like, oh yeah, I had some extra some bonus material that I added to the end of this that were like some more injection payloads that were like worked in more specific scenarios, and like I mean, it's really crazy research. So what is it? So basically, a lot of it boils down to the fact that there are certain characters that you can, that are valid in an email address, especially in the like first part of the email address, before the at symbol, that end up either being transformed or interpreted or parsed in a way that allows you to do way more than just provide an email. So oftentimes, you know, a lot of this was ending up as like SMTP injection, changing like the SMTP directives or commands that were being put in like a raw email, like text or like command or whatever that's getting sent to the email server. So yeah, I mean, it's really, really cool research. I think one of the coolest things was this whole like equals question mark encoding thing.
Yeah, dude, I freaking loved that part. Encoded word or whatever, right?
Yeah. RFC 2047, another RFC. Very good. It's called encoded word. Yeah, and it's like this encoding system that allows you to write encoded characters as like hex. And it's like so foreign, because if you look at this screenshot, you're like, what the heck is this? Like, I've never, this is a thing. Like, what is this thing? And yeah, apparently it is a thing. You can like send hex encoded characters, like an email address in like this raw format that like tells it, here's the character set, and here's like the data, and then it ends up decoding it somewhere.
I'm actually gonna paste this image into the doc really quick and make a note for Richie. Add this to the screen if possible. So for any of you watching on YouTube, hopefully that will be up on the screen right now. Essentially, Joel, when I saw this, I was super triggered, because I did a DEF CON talk back in 2022 with Sam Erb, essentially an exploitation story of how we popped this enterprise software, but it had some crazy parts to it. And one of the crazy parts was this sort of encoding that you see right here, which starts with like equals question mark. And then you provide like the encoding type, and then you do another question mark, and then you just essentially start writing the text you want with equal sign and then the hex value, equal sign, hex value, equal sign, hex value. This also works in HTTP headers, man. And so you can literally, let me link you to this presentation. I'm like, because I saw this and I was like, I was in prep for this episode and I was super triggered because I was like, oh my gosh, why didn't I look deeper into this? And I sent a message to Gareth and I was like, dude, have you seen this? And he's like, whoa, I didn't, like that can be done in HTTP headers as well. So there's definitely some cool applications for smuggling with this. I just sent it to you on Discord, but this type of encoding with the equal sign and the question mark.
Oh my god, and cherry pie.
Yeah, exactly, and cherry pie. It is a common way, it seems, for various internet systems, especially the stuff that was created way back in the day, like original HTTP protocol and original SMTP, to encode values that may not have a super clean UTF-8 or ASCII representation, right? And so he's using that again here to essentially get these emails to have sort of malicious characters in them, which then get misparsed by either the application layer or by, more impactfully, by the actual SMTP server that's sending all this stuff out, which is genius, really.
Dude, that's really, really interesting that, like, that is specifically in the code. I actually went and I looked, too, and it's still there.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, when you made this slide, but...
Yeah.
Sure looks... It's still, wait, did they fix something?
No,
or?
No. There's not. Oh,
okay.
You know, because
okay, I was gonna say yeah, because I think it still does.
I hit up CherryPY and CherryPY was like no, and then Nginx was like that's CherryPY's problem, and then they just so it's one of those you know mismatches again where it's like, Nginx doesn't see it, doesn't parse this sort of what is it ISO 8859-1.
Yeah, I mean, they literally use decode header from email.header.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's not fixed in CherryPY, and there's probably other HTTP servers that also support this ISO 8859-1 encoding type. And then there's also this sort of same sort of thing in emails, apparently, where a valid email can have like a bunch of question marks and a bunch of like hex encoding. And then when the email actually gets sent, you know, it'll get sent to whatever the ASCII representation of that is. So I'll give our listeners the benefit of the doubt here that they can maybe visualize this. Okay, guys, listen closely. So this email looks like equal sign question mark, UTF-8 question mark, Q question mark, and the ASCII representation in hex. So for example, ABC would be 61, 62, 63. So it's equals 61, equals 62, equals 63 at whatever.com. And then when the email actually gets sent, it gets sent to abc@whatever.com. And so it's really odd. And I think this is the main, I think you successfully identified, Joel, like this is the main takeaway, right? Like from this whole thing. Because if you look at all of the exploits that he has in that write-up, all of them take advantage of encoded word. So a really easy probe that you can throw out there really quick is just have your email in encoded word and send that in, and if you get the email, then okay, there might be something a little bit easier to you know, or this is an easy way for you to identify that this is something you need to look at a little bit deeper.
Right, and I think one of the big ways that he was able to take advantage of this was around like auto invite stuff as well, right? So like the yeah. This is basically
which is
like,
everywhere.
Yeah, it's like in an encoding bypass for like email. Especially, which is then used in a lot of different places. So like, say you have a work Slack, and anybody who signs up for that Slack with the company domain email gets automatically added to the workspace. Mm. Well, you encode your email in encoded word, and the front end goes, oh no, this is a different domain. Mm. And then the email system interprets it completely different, and it ends up going and like registering it, your account to you know, restricted domain that you might not have access to. And now you have access to, you know, this company Slack that you shouldn't have access to.
Yeah.
And I think that this, I don't think Slack was actually a specific example. I think GitHub or
Hold up, Joel.
Cloudflare?
Don't say anything. Stop saying words, man. Like, I literally, while we're writing this, I like wrote down a couple targets that I know do this. And I'm like, because literally I get back from DEF CON, I was sick. Then I like, and had some stuff going on for a week. And now this is my first week back from DEF CON. And the first thing I do is go read all the research and like prep for this episode. And I'm finally done with that. And now I'm ready to do some freaking hacking. So don't say any of the targets that have this, because I'm going to go try it right after this. And yeah, we'll see. I'll keep you guys updated if I make any money off of it. But but you're right, man. Yeah. Like any target that has this sort of implicit trust of email domain, yeah. We need to try this on, like 100%.
That hacker one.
Joel, stop it. Please. God. Okay, fine. Whatever. I won't go after that one. All right. Sweet. So let's see. Lots of other takeaways from this one, man. I'll take the next one here. So one of the ways that encoded word isn't going to solve your problem. There has to be encoded word plus some other quirk, right? So there's a couple ones that he mentioned here. And one of them we see is called UUCP. One of them is called source routing. One of them is called Unicode overflow. So I'll start at the top. Unix to Unix copy, UUCP, is a super whack protocol. And this protocol essentially allows you to provide this is my TLDR of the situation, you know, having read over it. Essentially, this allows you to provide an address for this SMTP interaction in this Unix to Unix copy address format, which has the domain before the actual user information, which is the inverse of email, right? The domain goes at the end for email. So essentially the way he discovered this, and I love how humble he is about the way he describes the way that he found this, because he's like, yeah, I just like jammed a bunch of characters into this thing. And all of a sudden I saw that I was getting like an invalid host resolution. And apparently he put a exclamation point character and / escaped the at symbol just by chance. In this setup, and then he like had the good sense to like go and actually figure out why that was happening, and then stumbled upon this vulnerability. But essentially, this protocol allows you to specify a destination for this SMTP interaction that is not in the traditional format, and you can specify the domain first, then a exclamation point that is your delimiter for the domain, and then a bunch of other information, and then use a / to escape the at sign. So that it isn't interpreted as an email address. So the front end application layer might think that this is an email address ending in, you know, @example.com, but actually this is a UUCP address that's domain is actually what is before the exclamation point, which is just sick. Like, it's absolutely like, sick.
It's like such a weird thing. And it makes me wonder now, like, maybe I need to go pick the brain of like somebody who like used Linux in like 1985.
Exactly, man.
Be like, hey, like, tell me about like all the annoying things you had to work around.
Yeah,
and tell me how that worked.
What is this UUCP thing? Like,
yeah.
Super.
I just need to
cool.
Ask them. Like, do you know what UUCP is? And if they know what it is, then I'm just gonna be like, okay, I have like 8 more questions for
you. Yeah, exactly. That's like the delimiter question. Like, okay, yes. Okay, sit down. You know, like, that's great. Yeah, so I want to say that this UUCP thing was enabled by default on like postfix?
I think it was postfix, yeah.
Yeah, dude, it's like it's pretty bad that this sort of stuff.
Yeah, it was postfix.
It's like, what is going on here? that this is still like a functional protocol. And this SMTP seems so disjointed from a lot of the stuff that, like, when I think about the application layer, I don't really include the SMTP server in that, right? Like, it's different.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those technologies that is extremely old. I mean, like, literally, like, I remember, like, taking, like, a intro to networking class and, like, opening Netcat, and you connect to an SMTP server and you go, like, EHLO, and it just, like, replies back, you know? Like, it's completely text-based protocol. It's, like, very, very... like simple. It's similar to HTTP in that sense, right?
Yeah, 100%. And also, yeah. I need to correct something, Joel. The UUCP protocol was not on Postfix. Postfix has a different thing, which we'll talk about in a second, the source routes. But sendmail 8.15.2 is the vulnerable configuration that he was using when he discovered this. So
okay, interesting.
Those are like the two main SMTP, you know, I think there's another one, but
he actually does say that Postfix actually supports UUCP as well.
Oh yeah, so, he says it later, right?
Yeah.
With the
I think it was no, it's actually pretty early on.
Oh, I later found out that if you use the single parentheses trick, Postfix also supports UUCP. Okay. Yeah.
You're right.
So sendmail and mind blown, man. Sendmail and Postfix both support this like ancient thing, which is pretty amazing. So that was one of the main takeaways there is like there's a bunch of so at a more concrete level, remember this whole UUCP trick with the exclamation point in backslash escaping the at sign when you're dealing with anything SMTP related. And then taking this concept a little bit bigger, whenever you have sort of tangential systems to your application layer, right? Like maybe your application layer in this situation, he like shits on Ruby a lot. So maybe your application layer is in Ruby, right? And then you've got some other thing you're interacting with, like an SMTP server, like that sort of thing. You got to think about what that second degree, what other sort of weird configurations and what kind of other weird protocols and variants that other piece deals with. Because I think we've seen that pattern of dealing with these sort of out of band entities and them supporting some weird old shit that we can exploit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of it is just like the backwards compatibility stuff and it's just been baked in and never removed. And, you know, it's like, why does Cherry Pie support that encoding? Like,
Who knows?
Like, yeah.
Okay. Next one is source routing. This one was another really cool old legacy variant, and specifically within source routing, the percent hack. And essentially, what this allows you to do is specify multiple domains that a specific entity should be sent to, a specific SMTP interaction should communicate with in one address, which is like perfect for this sort of thing, right? Like it's perfect. And how it works is you can specify, for example, like ABC, and then you do percent sign rhinorator.com at example.com, right? So the application layer is going to see that as an at example.com email address and give you access to like everything that's associated with that, you know, in your organization or whatever. But when that specific domain gets passed to an SMTP server that supports this sort of source routing percent hack scenario, it will send the email first to abc@example.com, then to abc@rhinorator.com, essentially cutting off the at sign at the end and then replacing the next percent sign with an at sign. And then sending the email there. So the actual like validation email that might get sent out would go to like abc@rhinorator.com, which is perfect because then you can snag that code.
Yeah, you know, very intuitive behavior everybody would expect. Like this is obviously how this is supposed to work. Yeah, like
why does
perfect
this
user experience.
Yeah. Why does this exist, man? It's crazy. I thought that was amazing though. I thought that was like literally like a dream come true scenario for hackers, right? It's like
I think one interesting thing about that for me is like I'd love to know if anybody's actually legitimately using this, like
probably not.
And if so, who and why? Like
it's time to retire, if that's the case.
Like I'm really curious like how much of this is just like legacy garbage that's just been like, you know, kept in because of the spec or, you know, who knows what, or if it's just like, you know, there's secretly like the entire banking system is using source routing or something.
Well, that could
like,
be like I could see that actually.
Yeah,
for sure. Okay, so we've got so far we've got UUCP, we've got encoded word UUCP and source routing. Another takeaway from this one was this whole concept of Unicode overflows, which I think was this one and Punicode, which is something we're going to talk about in a second. Well, I felt like we're like little bonuses to the actual email research. Like a lot of the stuff here that we just talked about was like, and I found this in the RFC and this is cool. And then the Unicode stuff and the Punicode stuff are both like, wow, this is some cool like ASCII management or like Unicode to ASCII conversions and normalization that are occurring. And then we can weaponize this in the email arena, but we can also weaponize this in other areas. So listen here, listen closely here for these next couple of ones if you are not, even if you're not necessarily interested in email related hacking, because
And also, like, real quick, I love that something finally is able to exploit PuniCode, because PuniCode is one of those things super that we're whack. You know, you're like testing like domain registrars, you know, all these different things. Usually it's like for SSRF, and you know, you input a domain and you're trying character like bypasses, and you try like, you know, some weird care set, and it turns it into a PuniCode domain. You're like, ah, that's so annoying. Well, there might actually be something there now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm looking, I didn't actually put a bunch of, I didn't write a bunch of notes on the whole PuniCode part. So maybe you can explain that one, or I can take a stab at it real quick. But the Unicode piece was really interesting, because the Unicode overflows, this goes into how Unicode is being processed and how, I guess even specific ASCII related stuff is being processed, because essentially what it would do, and he just noticed this while he was, I think, black box testing, and it was getting weird characters out of putting ASCII or Unicode into a place where the application expected ASCII. Essentially what was happening here was they were taking the Unicode code point and they were just running like mod 256 on this. So any you know, Unicode thing that would mod to 40, right? If you took the code point and then ran mod on it to give you the output there, anything that would convert to 40, including like this weird L and a bunch of other characters, would get normalized to an at sign. And then he was able to use that to like mess with some of the parsers for emails and kind of split the whole research is called splitting the email atom. And so the whole concept is like splitting the email domain where it shouldn't be, or getting things delivered to invalid locations because of that. And he was able to use these Unicode overflows to do that. And I think we'll see this 100%. We'll see this in other areas. I want to even say File Descriptor has an XSS out there somewhere on Twitter that utilized something similar to this. And it's not, just wasn't something that was on my radar actively until Gareth brought this back to my attention.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So for the PuniCode thing, very similar type of, you know, issue basically, where like you could force it to decode improperly. So I guess this was a bug in the PHP IDN library that would be used decode PuniCode itself. And you could basically just generate like arbitrary characters in PuniCode encoding by like writing them in this certain specific format and, you know, putting, I think it was just like, two zeros,
he says,
before.
I discovered that if you use two zeros at the start, you could generate unintended characters with PuniCode.
Yeah. Yeah. So with this, now you can have like valid domain, quote unquote, right? But when it gets decoded with, like, PuniCode is an encoding. It's not like a domain. I mean, it is for domains, but right. But like decoding it and having it be a valid domain are two separate things.
Right.
And so basically he was able to generate PuniCode valid strings that decode to invalid domains with like commas and ats symbols and stuff like that, that should never be in a PuniCode domain. And then when that would be used within like the SMTP protocol, or like, you know,
well, in this
the
specific
body
scenario,
of an HTML.
In the actual application layer, when it was displaying that email on the screen for the user to see.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So Joomla, I believe this was the big example. So Joomla was, you know, doing PuniCode decoding on your email address so that it would render properly in the web. But, you know, again, you can inject invalid email characters into a valid PuniCode string. And so when this gets decoded, now you have essentially HTML injection, which can lead to XSS.
Right.
So I think he was able to escalated all the way to RCE, apparently.
Yeah.
I think through template injection.
No, it was through CSS injection.
Okay.
And it's an interesting escalation to RCE, because despite all of his attempts here to generate a valid XSS payload with PuniCode, it seems like it is not possible to get that to actually do it. Gareth and also some of the other members of the PortSwigger research team spent a decent amount of time, it says, kind of poking around with this and couldn't get it to generate like a valid XSS payload. But what he was able to get it to do was generate an opening style tag. And then he was able to utilize the way that that style tag was placed adjacent to another injection point that he had to essentially be able to trigger a arbitrary CSS import.
It's like an XSS with two injection points, right? You have like one variable and you start your payload so it doesn't get fully filtered out. Mm-hmm. And the second variable, you finish your payload. And there's a bunch of junk in the middle, but it doesn't really matter because you have the start and the end that builds out a full payload that actually succeeds.
Exactly. Yeah. And so then, you know, of course, I love this with Gareth, right? Like, he's like, all right, well, we're in a CSS injection context. No problem. And then he like whips out where is this thing? He's like, so we needed now to exfiltrate the CSRF token via CSS. Thankfully, there have been many good posts on this, and the best way to do it is import chaining. As mentioned by Donut in Pepe Vila. And I decided to use, I, however, decided to use the custom or customize the tool that I already developed for my blind CSS injection research, which is just super badass. And that tool is amazing, by the way. So,
dude, and it's so funny because as I was reading this, I was thinking before I got to the end of that like paragraph, I was like, I wonder if that was like a sneak peek, like, oh yeah, it's here's the CSS injection tool. And then behind the scenes, he was like doing all this stuff and he wrote that tool just for this. And no, it was actually completely separate research that just like ended up being perfect.
Yeah, he's like, and I'll release that. And then a couple months later, I'll drop that. No, so that's great. And I love seeing CSS injection exploited in a really effective way here. I think in the end that this would still, because it's just a CSRF token exfiltration, I think that it still requires user interaction to pop this RCE. But, you know, such is life, man. I think it's still an RCE.
One-click RCE is better than zero-click. I mean, wait. One-click RCE is better than no RCE.
No RCE.
That's okay. Wow.
And I think I think also that there's potential to get this to zero click. We just need to sort of crack this puny code nut where it just will not generate the correct characters for any sort of XSS related payload. And he's able to get it to generate SVG, like an SVG tag. I just don't think that it can get to the point where it actually like has the correct event handler and doesn't have junk text in between. So,
right. Yeah. And I mean, I don't know how thorough, like how deep Gareth went with this and if he just stopped at the PHP IDN library, but one thing I remember vividly from one of Orange's earlier talks around URL parsing was the wide expanse of libraries that were tested and how many were vulnerable across like different languages, different implementations, like different commonly used, like, you know, here's this Python library, here's this Ruby library, here's this PHP library. And so I would be really curious to see how many other things are affected, like this, like Cherry Pie, like, you know, large HTTP framework library that is used by a lot of things, like just randomly supports this encoded word stuff. Like, you know, same thing. Like, how is the Punycode library for Python doing Punycode? Is it also vulnerable in the same way? And how many other, you know, web services and stuff could you affect in that way?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's kind of odd here because the Joomla code that's used specifically says Punycode helper :: email to UTF-8, right? So it's like explicitly doing Punycode decoding, I guess.
Right.
Decoding. I just said
decoding.
I promise English is my first language, guys.
Undeencoding.
Oh my god! Please stop, Joel. No. I think this is something that will probably not happen super implicitly. I think it's probably something that'll be more implicit throughout applications, but that doesn't mean that we can't still poke for it, especially when you have source code. It might be helpful even to start looking for like, oh, where's Punycode mentioned in here and how does that, why does it work that way? So very cool stuff there.
Super cool.
I don't think there's anything else on that one, so we'll call that a wrap on splitting the email, Adam. Next up is gotta cash them all. And
we might have a new little tagline,
dude.
We might have to just throw that in.
It's catchy, man. It's good. I really liked it. I think I think you said your favorite research was the email research, right?
Yeah, yeah, that was super cool. And I think this one is your favorite, right?
It is. It is. Yeah. I think this is the one for me. And the reason for this is like, wow. One, I wasn't as familiar with, I believe it's Martin, right? It's pronounced differently, but Martin's research. In the past, I haven't seen much from him, and I was really impressed with this research. And there, I think that a lot of the techniques that he talked about here were pretty known to the people that really know a lot about web cache deception and web cache poisoning.
Which, by the way, for me, like timing attacks and web cache poisoning are like the two, like they're like quantum computing to me, bro.
Really? It's like, what? Like, dude, we gotta like, talk about that.
I understand like, you know, how it works and stuff, but it's like such like a weird, like deep sort of attack scenario that like you really have to like be at a certain level with the application to be like, yeah, there's some like, there's some like caching stuff, and then like understanding how you can actually exploit them in
a different
way.
Level of like intimacy with the application. Is that what you would say?
I was avoiding it, but yes.
Okay. Come on, just lean into it, man. It's a catchphrase, man. Yeah, so I think this research was really good because what he did is he did the legwork. He did the legwork for everything. He went and he like, this whole research is filled with like these graphics that show how different systems, you know, Cloudflare, CloudFront, Azure, GCP, Apache, Nginx, how all of these things process various permutations on dot segments, right? So path traversals. Origin and cache level delimiters, like it's awesome. And he doesn't just say like, hey, sometimes this works. He says this works on this, 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 and this. And there's incompatibilities between this and this and this and this and this and this, right? And I love that. Like that is, also I just want to shout out how much of a grind that is, because you know what he had to do was like go and spin up each one of these services and like configure that shit, and that is boring stuff, right? That is not exciting security research. But
especially when you spend like 3 hours spinning one of them up, testing it, and then it doesn't work and you just go no on your spreadsheet and then you go to the next one.
Exactly. Exactly, man.
Like it's not even exciting. You're like, oh, now I have 50 things I can exploit. It's like, oh, damn. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
On the next one.
So major props to him for putting in the legwork and getting this research in place. And there were some pieces that I was not familiar with just in my own methodology in here. So props to him for that. And let's kind of talk a little bit about those. Okay. So this whole thing is about practical applications of these research, right? So with the research from James, you know, we're paying attention to these attacks. We're understanding how to use that domain label length. With Gareth's stuff, we're checking for encoded word. We're checking for some of these weird fringe things. Once we have identified that we have something funky here, or maybe if we're interested in email level authentication. And with this cache related stuff, man, there's a lot of takeaways, dude. Like fingerprinting your target will now give you so much of an insight into what is actually happening because of the research that he's done here. So first I need to make, I'm sorry, I'm going to rant a little bit here. Joel, can I cook for a second? Like,
go for
I'm
it.
I'm just getting,
let him cook.
Dude,
let him cook.
The apron's coming on. Like I got the chef hat. I'm ready to go. In the talk, he defines multiple different types of delimiters. He talks about origin delimiters, cache delimiters, front-end delimiters, and back-end delimiters, depending on the context, right? And there's two different types of caching-related bugs. There's web cache deception, which requires user interaction, and there's web cache poisoning, which doesn't require user interaction, okay? So, and I think the visuals that he had in the presentation and also in the actual, you know, write-up on the PortSpeaker website, really, really good for understanding. So Joel, if you are trying to get a better understanding of those, you know, giving that thing a twice, three times over might really clear that up for you. And so the concept of origin delimiters is like the backend server, right? Like we're thinking about, we've got a caching server in front and then we've got the origin server. Those are delimiters in the path that happen only on the origin server and not on the cache server, right? So he gave a bunch of examples of these. The one that's really common that a lot of us know about from the research that Orange did a couple years back is the semicolon, right? That being used in Spring environments and Tomcat, I think, as well, to delimit like a path parameter or a matrix parameter. So the difference between that being parsed as part of the path and it not being parsed as part of the path can mean the difference between what extension is used appears to be in place at the caching level and at the origin level. So let's say if the caching server is caching everything that ends in .js, right, or .css, then we can say /my account/userinfo:\.css, right? And the backend, when it's processing that, won't even pay attention to that semicolon part because it's a parameter. It's like if you had put a question mark, right? But the front end, the caching server, sees that as a path ending in .js or .css or whatever and says, ooh, I need to cache that. And he lists in the research, like Cloudflare has, I believe it's Cloudflare. Cloudflare has like this list of extensions, .7z, .avi, .avif, .apk, like Cloudflare by default caches all of these if it ends in this. So,
right. Which I guess makes sense, right? Yeah. Like from a CDN perspective, like most of those, at least the ones that you listed are like, you know, media files. Like you have to remember like CDNs, their business is bandwidth,
right.
Traffic. Right. And so like the more traffic, the more that costs them. Mm. And the more they have to serve that file over and over again, the more it costs them. So their whole goal is going to be to serve that file as few times as possible. And if it ever gets updated, update it as few times as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. They're definitely incentivized to go down that path. So it does make sense, but it definitely causes some bulms. So understanding what origin delimiters you have in your environment is pivotal to being able to trigger web cache deception and web cache poisoning, but he calls it the delimiter something different in that way. Mm. So let me just run through these really quick. So you got the semicolon for Spring and like Tomcat. You've got the dot for Rails, which is really interesting because I did know this sort of tangentially about Rails, but I hadn't really concreted in my brain. If you're dealing with a Rails environment, you can add dot and then whatever at the end and it'll still show you the same result in a lot of ways. And I didn't really know why that was. And the reason it is it's looking for, it's taking that dot and it's trying to decide what view to display in Rails. And if the dot doesn't have, if that extension that you provided after the dot doesn't have a registered view, then it will just show you the default view, which is such an amazing functionality, right? And so there are differences. This is one of the things that was in the presentation that wasn't in the actual research, that paper that he showed, was that there are a select set of Cloudflare caching extensions that are not also valid Rails extensions. So Rails won't even, like, if you try to give it, I think I screenshotted it or took a picture of it on my phone or whatever, but like maybe it's like .tiff or something like that, right? Rails will never serve but Cloudflare will always cache that, right? If that's at the extension. So Rails is going to fall back to the default view and show you whatever it normally does while still having that .tiff extension. And then Cloudflare will be like, oh, that's a .tiff file. So I got to cache that.
So weird.
It's That's rad, so dude. Weird. It's freaking rad.
I mean, again, it's like these weird intricacies of frameworks, right?
Yeah.
It's not even just like necessarily singular application vulnerabilities. It's like common configurations of things that are tied together, like Apache and some web server behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And like
reverse proxies, you know, like, caching proxies, all these.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So it's so interesting.
Okay, a couple more he listed. Null byte for open light speed, which I haven't seen quite as much of open light speed, but I mean, if he put it on there, it's probably decently sized. And then percent OA for Nginx rewrite rules, which has got to break a ton of things, man. Like if percent OA is truncating the path on Nginx rewrite rules, like that has got to break a ton of things. So that wasn't one that I was super using often in my web cache deception checks. So that is definitely one that I'll be adding. And to be honest, what he recommended in that scenario is just like hit everything in ASCII range. Just give it a shot, you know, try it encoded, try it not encoded, try it double encoded and see if there's any differential between the two. So I might just make a massive list of every ASCII character, every encoded ASCII character, and then every double encoded ASCII character. And just whenever I have a suspicion about any of this, just like throw that whole list at it and look for the outliers.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I was going to suggest. Cause I mean, like you said, like none of this is like necessarily new research, but I think it's like a great sort of like reference to have. Like, you know, if you come across, you know, some cache poisoning, then take a look at this article and go through and be like, okay, let me try this, this, this until something works. Or you can just do what you said and have that list of all the characters, fuzz everything, and something will work probably. I mean, if you have a, if there's an issue there.
Yeah, and I think there are some new pieces of research in here, just to be clear. Oh, okay. But like this, this specific set, I think, has been, I'm not sure if it's known publicly, but at least known within the like people that actively exploit web cache deception and other stuff environment, just being like trading this tip with your friend or whatever, that sort of thing. But it's just nice to see it formalized, you know? And then, so as far as cache delimiters go, so something that the caching server thinks is a delimiter that isn't a delimiter on the backend server, there's not a lot of them besides like maybe question mark sometimes if it's encoded and passing along the encoded value or the unencoded value. The unencoded. Why do I do this? The decoded value.
De-encoded.
Why do I do it? I don't know. But he had a great point switching from web cache deception to web cache poisoning, which is a non-user interaction required attack where you poison cached assets for other users, that the hashtag can really cause some havoc. And essentially the cache server seeing that as a delimiter and the backend not, or vice versa, right? And since we're not limited by the browser having to force the user to make a request in their browser, we can send like the hashtag in an HTTP request to the server in just directly with like burp or Kaido, and then see how that actually gets processed and how, whether the caching server discards it at the caching server level or whether it gets considered to be a part of the path at the origin level. And there's once again, another great graph in here that is just like blowing my mind of the amount of variance between whether hashtag is a delimiter in these various entities, right? So Cloudflare, no. CloudFront, yes. GCP, error. Azure, yes. Imperva, no. Apache, error. Nginx, yes. OpenLight, no. Like Spring, error. Rails, yes. Django, no. Like it's like everything it parses this differently.
Oh man.
And so
you know what would be awesome, like follow-up research from him would be like some sort of just like simple Docker, like a repo with like 15 Docker containers in it.
Oh my god.
That you just like spin them all up and then you could just like send one request to all of them.
That is called HTTP Garden.
Whoa.
And actually I met the guy, I met the guy who wrote this, at the Google Live hacking event in Vegas. And I like didn't know who he was.
Dude, this is sick.
And I was like hanging out with him and then he was like,
"It's a collection of HTTP servers and proxies configured to be composable along with scripts to interact with them in ways that makes finding vulnerabilities much, much easier." That's
awesome. It's awesome, man. And I was like talking to him about it and I was like, "Hey, you know, have you like heard of HTTP Garden or whatever?" And he's like, "Yeah, I wrote that." And I'm like, "What? Like, are you kidding me? You're the guy that wrote HTTP Garden?"
Dude, this is crazy. Like,
thanks,
like literally like you just like give it a payload and like with the /r/ns and it just prints out a freaking table.
Yeah. Also, dude, this guy that wrote this, Ben is his name. Let me see if I can find. Yeah, Ben Callis. It was so funny because we were like hacking together at the live hacking event or whatever, and just like sharing interesting leads and stuff. And I was like, "Yeah, so just open up like Kaido or open up Burp or whatever." And he's like, "What?" And I'm like, "Open up those." And he's like, "Oh, I don't use that. I just I use printf and netcat."
Oh, dude,
and I'm like,
what?
And, oh, and it's so funny too, dude. If you look in the like readme for HTTP Garden, you see a bunch of stuff like that. Like he's clearly very used to just writing HTTP requests by hand on the command line like a total badass. Like, and so
it's just like payload. It's just like get slash HTTP slash 1.1 backslash R backslash yeah, N host colon like, A backslash R, like one liner HTTP request.
So anyway, shout out to Ben, dude, you rock. Thank you for developing this tool that allows us to test a bunch of HTTP servers and proxies really, really easily. Also, maybe learn how to use Burp. But also, let me just say, like, he also told me, he's like, yeah, I mean, because like this is the ultimate level of control, right? There's no weird like parsing error in Burp or like nothing. Everything you write is like you intentionally wrote that character, which is great, and I can see how that would be really helpful in like HTTP request smuggling, which I think he does a lot of, and other stuff like that. But man, for like testing IDORs, that sucks, you know. Like, so yeah, very cool research there, and yeah, that does exist, Joel, already.
I will say, HTTP Garden. Probably the most interesting thing. I mean, other than everything else. But what has really caught my eye in this HTTP Garden readme is under the acknowledgement section, it says, this material is based upon work supported by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, under contract number HR00119C0076.
Wow, dang, dude. Like, all right. Thanks, DARPA.
Just thanks, DARPA.
Hooked us up.
DARPA's
with, like,
doing HTTP server research. That's totally...
That. Dude, apparently there's like a major DARPA... AI competition or something like that, AI cyber challenge, that's like something like $4 million is the number one prize or something like that.
Dude, what?
Yeah, it's kind of nuts. I think this is more
life hacking.
Like,
listen up.
Exactly. I think it's more of like a I want to say it's more of a like company oriented thing, but still pretty baller. $4 million, that's
crazy.
Like massive. All right, cool, man. So let's see, where are we at? Okay, we went down a little tangent there.
DARPA contracts.
Yeah, hashtag really cool delimiter to use. Send it not through the browser, but through your HTTP proxy, and try to get something to cache incorrectly, because the back end truncates the path and the front end doesn't, or vice versa, right? And we see scenarios in this is hashtag a delimiter table that he created in his write-up, where some origin servers will see it as a delimiter, some won't, some caching servers will see it as a delimiter, some won't. So it's like, if you can get a mismatch between the two, and there are a lot of mismatches, then if anything is being cached, then you should be able to do some cool cache poisoning with this. And cache poisoning is like massively impactful, I think.
Yeah.
Like, I won't name any names or call out any scenarios, but I was at a live hacking event. I was talking with a hacker that wasn't on my radar, and recently came on my radar, and we were talking about the vulns that he found, and he's like, yeah, I found this cache poisoning that did this, like, essentially one of the most internet breaking things I can possibly think of, and he got some crazy bounties for it, and all because of understanding thoroughly how to manipulate these caches. So specifically, yeah, cache poisoning. Like, I find web cache deception pretty often. I've not found web cache poisoning as much. And I think I'm sleeping on that personally.
Yeah. So this is awesome research. So yeah, definitely going to put this one in my bookmarks for whenever I come across some cache poisoning.
Yeah. Any caching sort of like functionality, really. And I'll talk about that as well here. Like, there are some caching strategies. I love that he made this more concrete, because it, like, so much of this for me was like intuition and like, well, if the caching is happening here, then this, that, and the other thing. But he built out three categories of web cache poisoning strategies. Okay. Caching by extension. If the server is caching by extension, right? That's, we listed a bunch of extensions earlier that are helpful for this. If they're caching by static paths, so essentially everything under slash static gets cached. That's a common configuration, right? Or if they're caching default files. So essentially that is Cloudflare by default will cache robots.txt or like sitemap.xml or whatever, right? And so you can potentially use those default caching rules along with a path traversal or like a path truncation with the hashtag to make the caching server think that this is robot.txt that I'm caching, but it's actually slash user account slash information or whatever, or like even some invalid thing will DOS these endpoints. So very cool stuff there. Okay, Joel, I'm sorry. One last thing on this, okay? Just give me just one more second, okay? I promise. Dot segment normalization, so path traversals. The graph that I'm looking at right now needs to be seen by the world, right? I put it in the doc, Joel. This is crazy, right? There is so much variance in how a path is normalized between various different web servers. This is really eye-opening to me. Like, I knew that this was happening at some level, but I hadn't seen how much variance there was. There's a ton of variance.
Yeah, I mean, it's like literally, what, 50-50?
Yeah, like, it's 50-50. It's like Cloudflare does not normalize it before it passes it through. Neither does Apache. Nginx does. IIS does. CloudFront does. GCP doesn't. Puma doesn't. Fastly doesn't. Imperva does. Like, it's like there's so much variance there that should be exploitable. I'm surprised I don't find more dot normalization bugs.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, like, I think, like, one of the biggest interesting things here for me is, like, just Apache versus Nginx, right? Probably, I don't know the numbers, but I would guess those are, like, the two most widely used web servers, or, like, you know, at least somewhere in the stack.
For sure.
And they do it differently.
Yeah.
They're not even consistent with each other, right? Like, of all the things that I would expect to be consistent with each other, I would expect Apache and Nginx to be essentially mirrors of each other, and yet they are not. And it's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that might have to do with, I'm looking at this configuration here, how Nginx deals with like %2F and stuff like that, which is an issue that I exploited really recently. And essentially Apache requires a specific configuration to decode %2F as a path segment. If it's given %2F rather than a slash, and Nginx does not. So that's exploitable in a lot of contexts. So definitely keep an eye out for that. Anytime you're thinking about how you may have a specific limited path and may be able to add things onto the end and then traverse back, because %2F is perceived by those servers as a path delimiter.
Yes, so interesting.
All right, dude. That's all I had on Gotta Catch 'em All. You got anything else here? Or are we moving along?
No, nothing else. I do have a little extra thing at the end.
Okay.
So, are we there? Are we there? Are we at the end?
Yeah. I mean, I think I am going to chat very briefly about Orange's write up. Do you want me to do that now or later?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. So, last piece of research from DefCon/Black Hat that we're going to cover this week. So essentially this is my hit list: Portswigger research and Orange. Was this research by Orange, who just decided, I love the quote. Let's see if I can find this quote in here. He's like, yeah, you know, when I do research, I like to break a bunch of stuff, the most hardened stuff, the stuff that people use everywhere. And so I said, why don't I attack Apache? I was like, no. He says, as you know, I always aim to challenge big targets that can impact the entire internet.
Big deal.
Yeah, he hit the nail on the head here, right? And I think he does a little humble flex later on in this post where he says, I am now the number one holder of Apache CVEs, which is super badass in my opinion. And the research was really cool and stuff that I really couldn't believe. Like, there was essentially, he figured out a way with a very, very common Apache configuration to just get arbitrary file system read and just dump it. The payload is so simple too. It's like %3F will truncate the path in a specific scenario, and then the path will get misinterpreted from a URL to a file system file. And then you can literally just write site.com/var/www/ and then just give it a full path, and it'll just, or /etc/password, it'll just dump it. It's like, what is going on here?
That's crazy.
And so I was like, when I saw this, I didn't really believe it, to be honest. Like, I was like, I don't think this works this way. So I like fired up my Apache server or whatever. And of course it didn't work that way. and I was like, why isn't it working this way? And I was like, oh, I'm patched, because they've already pushed it and like I've updated my Apache server. But yeah, like, he was spitting out this error saying, like, you need to have a flag you know, unsafe percent 3F or unsafe 3F or whatever. And I Google that, and freaking Orange's open internet bug bounty HackerOne disclosed report pops up saying, like, so they fixed it with, you know, unsafe 3F flag. And it's just, anyway, really amazing research. We've seen in the web cache research that Nginx rewrite rules have problems with percent OA. We've seen here that Apache has confusions on their rewrite rules with percent 3F, the question mark. I bet that there are a lot of weird inconsistencies with rewrite rules in general on web servers. That's a great area for research for anybody who's looking to do HTTP stack research.
Dude, I mean, per usual, I think, I don't know if I've told this story before. I don't know if I can tell this story. Maybe I can't tell the story. One time. I'm not gonna.
Oh my god, Joel, come on. Don't bait us like that. You gotta give us something. No.
Let me just say this. If you ever receive a report from Orange,
yeah,
it's gonna be a bad day.
Yeah. I believe that. I absolutely believe that. So yeah, there's lots of cool stuff in here. I'm gonna be honest with you guys. I read this through once and I picked up some things, but I really honestly need to read it again before I feel super comfortable talking about the technical details of it. The problem with this research right now is it's a great read and you can see like the methodology and like how he found all these things and like the impact and be like, whoa, that's nuts. The problem with it is they're patched. Thank God, right? Or else the internet would be breaking, I mean, right? Yeah. And so, you know, a lot of the configurations that you're going to see are going to be patched against this. But if you can find Apache servers that haven't been updated, I think it would be very valuable for any of the recon boys out there. I know you recon boys are listening, to essentially take a look at how this research works and try to create some fingerprinting for a server that may be vulnerable to this and then try to pop it, because the configurations that are required for these exploits to work are extremely common and are even in the Apache documentation. And so I think it should be very doable to find vulnerable servers that have vulnerable configurations with this at scale if you get creative with your nuclei templates or your scanning environment, like your scanning modules.
Yeah, totally.
All right, man, that's all I had on this one. I'm not going to go too deeper into this one, but yeah, percent 3F does weird things on Apache rewrite for sure.
Okay, so a little bit of extra interesting thing.
Okay.
I got nerd sniped by you and this research.
Lovely.
I was looking at the Python Codex library, the built-in library. It's called Codex. And sure enough, they have IDNA parsing. They have Punycode parsing. And,
Hold on. This is not the trusted types thing?
This is not the
trusted types thing. Joel, what is wrong with you, man? Okay, all right, fine. Go. Tell me about it.
But I was looking at the source code, and I think it's probably... You could probably sneak some things through there. That's what I'm thinking.
Oh, really? The Python Codex...
Yeah, it seems to be pretty. I mean, it's just like,
there doesn't seem to be checks for those sort of conversion errors.
I mean, it could be just the usage and the use case, because it seems like Punycode is basically like a separate thing, and then there's the IDNA stuff for like domain names specifically, and IDNA will do like extra stuff to normalize the host name or whatever. But so I'm still poking at this, but I think if it. Other languages, other implementations of the IDNA /IDN and Punycode parsing, probably
vulnerable. Take it, guys. Vulnerable. Take it and run with it. Gareth, you know, that's the thing with these, man. Like, reading the research is cool and doing stuff. And I was telling myself this as I was reading it. I was like, reading this research is cool, but at the end of the day, it's not going to do me any good if I don't implement any of this. So what I told myself is I need to go build Kaido workflows to detect some of this caching stuff. I need to actually add it to my like brain to actually check for encoded word whenever I'm dealing with email-based stuff. And I need to start paying more attention to timing-based stuff when I'm dealing within a black box environment where I'm trying to figure out what's going on. Because I think there is a lot of stuff a lot of doors that can be opened by all of those research techniques.
Yeah. And one other just last little interesting tidbit is that they actually tell you in the official documentation from Python, docs.python.org, if you need the IDNA 2008 standard from RFC 5891 and RFC 5895, use the third-party IDNA module. And they just link you to a PyPI package that some guy made. So just keep that in mind, that also the official docs will refer you to a third-party library on PyPI that who knows how that's been implemented as well. So just food for thought, more attack surface, and I will certainly be taking a look at it, and I would recommend other people do too.
Yeah, very cool. All right, yeah. Solid. Did you have anything on trusted types that you wanted to talk about this week, or are we going to push that to next week?
No, we got to do that next week. I haven't done a deep enough dive on it, but I will say trusted types API, very interesting. Seems like something that could be useful or potentially very dangerous. Mm-hmm. I hadn't heard of it until recently, but like the little synopsis that they say is that it's basically a way for web developers to lock down certain parts of the DOM to avoid client-side XSS. Mm. I guess mainly specifically this seems to be for DOM XSS is my guess.
Yeah.
Maybe Reflective would fall into this somehow, but yeah, you'd mentioned that you knew a little bit about it, but hadn't done a deep dive, and I haven't done a deep enough dive. So, yeah, it's very interesting.
It is indeed.
I hadn't heard about this.
I know that File Descriptor has a tool called Untrusted Types, which I think helps like monitor syncs for DOM XSS that utilizes or abuses trusted types, as he says in the description. So, all right, let's double click into that a little bit more next week.
Awesome.
And we'll swing back around to that. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Sounds good.
All right. Sounds good. That's a wrap on this episode. Peace, guys.
Yes, sir. Peace.
And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for listening. And if you want more Critical Thinking content, head over to ctbb.show/discord. Join the Discord. There's lots of great conversations and chats going on over there. And if you want to support the show, there's the Discord subscriber tiers, which give you access to masterclasses, AMAs, hackalongs, exclusive scripts, and an exclusive chat channel with us. We'll see you there.